Report cards are starting to be issued in the college admissions scandal. The trial over whether you could go into your neighbor's house, shoot them up, and then say, oops, wrong house, begins and ends, and a New York court rules that a lawsuit against Jerry Seinfeld is really a lawsuit about nothing. These stories, plus my interview with Taylor Phillips, who will talk about how improv can improve your life in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Well, it's report card time for many involved in the college admission scandal, and it does not look good for the legal system. Here's what I mean. First of all, can we all just dispense with a fake disdain over what these parents did? I mean, come on. They tried to game the system so their kids could get into a better college that within a few years they would be booted out of. Bad parenting? Yeah, they're guilty as charged. It's called natural consequences, Aunt Becky. Let them learn. But folks, if college is meant to prepare young kids for the real world, hello, that is the real world. I mean, remember what prompted the impeachment inquiry? Vice President Joe Biden's son got a cushy job on the board of directors of a Ukrainian energy company at the ripe age of 28, where he was paid $50,000 per month. Folks, this podcasting gig pays well, I assure. But let me tell you, it's somewhere less than $50,000 per month. And I am guessing that most of you listening make something short of that as well. So getting 50 grand a month to sit on a board of directors at the age of 28 is a good gig if you can get it. But the criteria include being an offspring of the rich and famous. So yeah, rich kids do get some perks along the way. Come on. Did you really think that George W. Bush got into Yale because of his SATs? So please, spare me the fake disdain. That's just how the real world works. But then secondly, let's take a look at the prison terms these people were facing for this crime. Now, it was widely reported that Lori Loughlin and the others were facing 20 or more years in jail for the college admission scandal. But now the sentences are coming out, and Felicity Huffman got 14 days in jail. Another parent, Stephen Sempervivo, got 4 months in jail. So, wait, 20 years were threatened, but only 14 days ended up being the punishment? All right, something is not right here. Either these prosecutors really didn't understand what the law said, or we have a judge who would make the worst parent ever. Now, Billy, you know you shouldn't throw your spaghetti dinner on the floor and start fires in the living room. Now, you go to your room where your computer is, and you think about what you've done. And don't come out until I finish cleaning up this mess for you. Yeah, really bad parenting. In reality, though, this is common practice. Prosecutors overcharging or threatening defendants to force them to give up their rights to defend themselves. But do you know what else is a common practice? Bullying. Yes, just ask Melania Trump. She is fighting it. And now, here's the thought I have for us. How is this not legal bullying? Prosecutors are way over threatening people with punishment that apparently is nowhere near the proper punishment. Now, why are they doing this? Just to force people into doing what the prosecutor wants and giving up their right to defend themselves. I mean, come on. This is mafia-style tactics, but it's just business as usual in our criminal justice system. I think it stinks, and I'm a lawyer in the system. Well, last week, the Geiger trial began and ended. Now, this was the high-profile criminal trial where a Dallas cop, off-duty, went into the wrong apartment, thinking it was hers, and shot the person living there, apparently thinking he was a burglar in her apartment. Now, let me just make some observations. This lady did not win a Heisman Trophy at USC, have a Hall of Fame football career, or star in the highly acclaimed movie trilogy called Naked Gun. All right. It was highly acclaimed by me. It was rawed by the Academy's greatest movie ever. That's all I'm saying. But Geiger is not O.J. Simpson, nor can she run through airports the way he did or hire, now this is the important part, hire a dream team of lawyers. The O.J. Simpson case took 8 months from the opening kickoff to the final buzzer. The Geiger case took 3 days. I mean, you hardly had time to look up the guide on your remote to find out where this case was being covered. So do you think money can buy justice? Well, to those of you doubting that, let me just say you're an idiot. But hey, seriously, call me. A prince from Nigeria needs a bank account number, and I think you're the person for that gig. But when it comes to getting time with Lady Justice, let me tell you, you pay by the hour. So apparently Geiger's attorneys did not attend the O.J. Simpson trial strategy workshop, or else the retainer was a bit thin. Either way, this was swift justice. All right, but how did she defend herself? Well, she defended herself using the castle theory. A person is allowed to defend their castle, and that's all she was doing, even though she was in the wrong castle. Well, the jury returned a verdict of guilty, and she is now going to jail for murder, which is good. I don't think anyone would want the precedent established that you could just go into your neighbor's house after they refuse to return your rake, shoot them up, and then say, whoops, wrong house. That would not be a good precedent, although it might tend to lead to more pleasant HOA meetings. You might see more neighbors getting along if they knew that the other neighbor could walk into their house in the middle of the night, shoot you, and then, in the words of Urkel, say, did I do that? Jerry Seinfeld was back in the legal news. A court dismissed a lawsuit against Seinfeld where a person claimed that Jerry stole the concept of comedians in cars getting coffee. Now, in case you missed it, Seinfeld has been keeping himself busy post-sitcom days by interviewing other comedians in cars while drinking coffee. That, my folks, is my dream job. Oh, comedians, cars, coffee. I live for coffee. But it's also an illusion. All right, here's the true story. I borrowed my friend's Lamborghini to do this bit called Lamborghini Lawyer. Now, I pulled into drive-thrus and I would ask legal questions just for the shock value. You normally don't see a Lamborghini in a drive-thru at, let's just say, McDonald's, and you normally don't see the questions going the opposite direction. So I ordered a coffee, and do you know what I learned? You can spend $500,000 on a car and still it does not come with cup holders. That's right. There was not a single place in that Lamborghini to place my cup of coffee. I had to throw it out. So now you know, if you go to purchase a Lamborghini, ask for the upgrade and get cup holders. Apparently those do not come in the base model. All right, but back to Jerry's case. The court didn't say that Jerry didn't steal the idea. The court just dismissed the case because the plaintiff took too long to file the lawsuit and the statute of limitations had already run its course. Now, you see, you wait too long to bring a lawsuit and you are in danger of the court saying, no suit for you. All right, sorry. I know that's bad. I know, low-hanging fruit, but it had to be said. Now, this was not Jerry's first time in court over the content of his shows. Several years ago, Michael Costanza, a college roommate of Jerry's, sued Jerry, claiming that he based the character of George off of him. All right, now just think about that for a second. Some people are totally willing to debase themselves to get a chance at winning the litigation lottery. Now, it's one thing to sue because you put coffee in your crotch and got burned. I mean, heck, I might even do that. But I would never claim what Michael Costanza claimed. His entire legal theory was based on Jerry basing the character of George off of him. All right, think about that. He is going into court under penalty of perjury, mind you, saying, look at that character, George. Just look at him. He's short. He's fat. He's bald. He's ugly. He can't keep a job. He has no luck with women. Well, guess who was the inspiration for that character? Mwah, just look at me. I am short, fat, bald, and ugly. Haven't had a decent paying job in years, and also could not get a date. Yeah, not too many people will be swiping right for that. Well, today's guest is Taylor Phillips, amazing young woman. I discovered her when I was doing some research for my upcoming class called From Improv to Courtroom Jokes, Using Humor in the Law. Now, the thought behind this class is to incorporate improv techniques into the legal practice and maybe a side benefit to stop attorneys from jumping off of cliffs. Well, to enhance, the thought is here is the improv techniques might enhance your self-confidence, improve your ability to think on your feet, and of course, to make people laugh, and everyone loves to laugh. Everyone loves to have a good time. So without further ado, here is Taylor. Well, I am here today with Taylor Phillips. Now, if you have not heard of her, you will. She is not only extremely funny, I mean, bring you to tears of funny, but she's also a Harvard grad as well, which to my count means in the last four episodes of this podcast, we have interviewed two Harvard grads who know how to make people laugh. So, Taylor, the question I have is Harvard just a big party? I mean, why is it that all you Harvard grads are so funny?
Well, thank you very much. That was very, very sweet. What I like to say is, you know, I also tutor because I did go to Harvard and I am a comedian, but I still am not smart enough to figure out how to make those things make me money immediately. So I also tutor students, and something that we talk a lot about, obviously not with the parents themselves, but with the students, is they're like, oh, is everybody at Harvard kind of stuck up? Or are they all right, really smart? Like, why are you, like, what did you do that was amazing to get in there? And what I kind of say is, I think that, you know, obviously they let in the geniuses, but then also some of us have to be the normals so that we, you know, like, make fun of all the startup founders so that they, like, kind of check themselves for a hot second before they go off into the world and everybody worships them.
Oh, I'm fascinated by this, see, because I want to know what life is like as a Harvard student. I mean, yes, I saw the movies about that. What was that movie called with that certain blonde, Reese Witherspoon? I think she attended Harvard Law.
Legally Blonde.
Legally Blonde, that's it. So I assume Harvard is just like that. But, you know, hey, when I was young, I wore T-shirts that said Harvard, but that's as close as I got. So when did when did you first decide that Harvard was in your future?
When I didn't get into Yale.
Okay. All right. That was your first sign. Right. Okay.
No. So it's a well kept secret, I think, sometimes, that at least where I'm from, because I'm from Kansas City, Missouri, and I really didn't even consider it an option. Like, you know, I knew that I liked school. I knew that I was pretty good at it. I thought maybe I would want to explore the Ivy League. But nobody says they want to go to Harvard.
Right, right.
That's like, that's such a
not openly. They might think
thing
it.
To say. Right. Well, but I didn't think it because I was like, that's not, you know, I'm better than that. I'm better than just wanting to go to the school from Legally Blonde. And at the time, actually just at the time, The Social Network, because I think that came out in 2010 and I graduated high school in 2011. And so, you know, I was exploring, like looking at schools. I was very interested in going to the East Coast. And when it seemed like, you know, I applied to Harvard, and then after I applied, I started actually researching the school. I was kind of like, okay, well, I'll do it. Which again sounds, you know, now I tell my students this and their jaws drop. It's just the most like presumptuous, but also naive thing in the whole world.
So you did a shotgun approach. You just said, hey, I'm going to apply.
Exactly. Totally. And my essay actually was, there were two, and I wrote one that was just my regular college essay. And then I wrote one that was like, pretty bold and pretty sassy, if not irreverent, about the college admissions process. And my thinking with that was, you know, I'm going to do this to Harvard. I'm going to go hard and say what I really think. And if they let me in, they're letting the real me in.
All right.
And at almost all the other applications, I was sort of tailoring. I was like, what do they want to hear? Who do they want me to be? And the Harvard one was really, you know, I showed it to my dad. I didn't let my parents edit anything, but I did show it to them and say, like, does this sound like me? And my dad just handed it back to me and said, if they let you in, they know what they're getting.
All right. And, so it's almost like you said, hey, with Harvard, I'm not getting in, so I just don't care. I'm just going to tell it like it is, and we're going to move on. And lo and behold, I guess they liked it.
It worked out. They did. They said I could go there if I wanted.
So is that your advice to students? Just be yourself and let the chips fall where they may?
I think the biggest thing, and working with students who are applying to colleges is one of my favorite things, but it's also really sad because I'm talking these kiddos out of a lot of times what their parents think and what their college counselors think that college admissions want to hear. And what I try to say is from here on out, we're going to think about what we're going to write your essay about. But from here on out, weird is the best word. If somebody tells you that you do something and it's weird, or you have a consistent habit that people think is weird, that's amazing. And we want to talk about why you do that. And we want to talk about who you are and follow that, because that's what's going to make somebody think that they know you as a person.
I like
and
that.
And the more a complete person you are, the more that they're going to see, be able to see how you fit into their school, regardless of whether it's, you know, UMich, whether it's a community college program, whether it's an Ivy, all of them are just human beings reading a piece of paper, trying to construct another human being in front of them.
I like to embrace the weird. That is who
yeah.
you are. If someone says that's weird, embrace that. So I have to know, since you brought it up, you are involved in counseling people and getting into colleges, the admission process. So exactly at what point does the non-existent rowing skills come into play?
Sorry, the non-existent what?
Rowing skills. Surely you heard about the controversy about people trying to
buy their way into
the rowing team. Does that ever come up?
So I have been fired one time for refusing to write an essay for a student. So I work for a wonderful organization that does a really good job of screening those people out for the most part. And usually I do a pretty good job of when parents are kind of hinting, oh, could you maybe help them figure out how to word this, of very quickly saying, oh, I actually have a policy. I don't write anything for my students. I just talk them through it. And usually the parents are like, oh, no, I was not presuming anything like that. But this particular young woman, and she was wonderful. The girl herself, it's really, really quite a bummer because this student was really a wonderful, wonderful young woman. But her guardian was insistent or was disappointed, so to speak, that the work that we produced in about 5 hours of work was not a finished product, which... with most of my students, again, this is a 7 to 10 hour process. If you know, from conception to creation.
Right.
And the guardian actually said, well, I'm going to have to go in and make so many edits because you didn't write it for them. And I said, you know, you should not be making any of the edits. And then I just, you know, I sent a masterpiece of a passive aggressive email, just sort of reiterating my policy, giving a few tips for moving forward, and saying basically, I'm sorry, it didn't work out. But I've been very fortunate to only have one student. And I think that, you know, and that was the parents. And I think for the most part, my students are wonderful, motivated kids who they and their parents just want to give them the best shot possible, and they're open to learning. And eventually we get them to the point where they can tell their own story, and they get a little bit of an essay that's them, that they're proud of.
Fascinating. That is a fascinating insight. And I had no idea that world even exists. Now I'm a lawyer, and I kind of, I was reading what you were saying there. I was getting an idea, because that comes up in my practice, where people will, let's say the deposition is coming up and they're going to testify, and they're wondering, what should I say? And my first response is, well, you know, the truth is not a bad place to start. What do you want me to tell you? How to lie in court? No, that's not what lawyers do. But hey, nonetheless, I do love Aunt Becky. And so I am following that case with a lot of fascination. But it's kind of nice to know someone who's on the inside there and helping people with the application process. Well, I know you are in comedy, and I want to cover your expertise in making people laugh. But first, I just have to know, did you want to be a funny person as a career before going to Harvard? Or did that come up in the interview process at any point in time?
So it's funny, because I actually don't know the answer to that question. And I'm sure that I could talk to my parents and my sisters and figure it out. But I've always been a performer. I was in the after school acting program when I was seven. And when I was seven, I'm 5'6", and I've been 5'6" since I was 10 years old. So, and I am not skinny. I've never been skinny. And so I was, as a kid, as a middle schooler and growing up, I was always bigger, and I was always put in these character parts, where you had the opportunity where, even if you didn't get the prettiest songs, you got the laughs. And I think that that's a really common thing that happens to not thin girls, or really just to girls that have a distinct look to them, or maybe, you know, or even just don't have a soprano voice in a lot of roles. So funny was always something that was sort of initially forced upon me, and then I sought it out. It's, you know, less rehearsal and a higher return.
Now, Taylor, isn't that intoxicating when you actually can make someone laugh? I mean, as someone who does that as a living, I just want your perspective on that. Is that not just, I don't do drugs, but I can imagine that is a high that you feel.
Well, it's so, you know, when you do it from such a young age. I remember I was 16, I think, before I was in my first quote unquote straight play, my first drama. And it was an Agatha Christie play and it was a mystery. And I remember the opening night feeling like, why does this feel so weird? Why does this feel so weird? And then I realized I didn't have laughs or applause, which laughs you get in comedies and applause you get in musical theater. I had no way of getting the audience's approval until the very, very end of the show. And it was one of those things where, of course, I liked the laughter and the applause, but like you said, I didn't realize that I was jonesing for it until I started going into that withdrawal. And it is, I mean, there's nothing like it. And then I started writing or making choices, or directing, I started realizing that I could, the double gratification of not only the delivery that you're giving, but also the fact that it's a joke that you wrote.
Oh, yes.
So the idea of, oh, I'm on the same page with this audience, that I did something that they appreciate. I did something that struck a funny bone with them, but also I thought of it before I even got here.
Oh, it's intoxicating. It really is. It's a high.
It is. There's nothing like it.
All right. So you do make people laugh. You are a Harvard grad, and your bills are paid. So I know life is going good for you. Now, I also have a law degree, and I'm looking to make people laugh for a living, because I think laughter is what we all want to do. Let me ask you about this, because I believe that we were designed by our creator to laugh. I mean, we're drawn to it. And here's my test for you, and I want to see what you think. But here's my test to just prove that we are designed to crave laughter. All right, here's the test. You have a choice on what to do on a Friday night. Now, Friday night's coming up here, and you can either, one, go to a Jerry Seinfeld concert. He's in concert. I have free tickets for you. Or you could go to a funeral and listen to a eulogy. Which one are you choosing?
I think I'm definitely picking Seinfeld.
Yeah, I mean, who would voluntarily pick to go to a funeral? Now, I do like the potato salad that's offered at funerals, but still, yeah, I'm pretty sure everyone is going to pick the Jerry Seinfeld concert. Now, Jerry Seinfeld told this joke where he said the number one fear of people is not dying, it's public speaking. And so he said that means if you go to a funeral, you'd rather be the one in the casket than the one doing the eulogy. Well, nonetheless, you passed that test. Again, I've given that test in a lot of my classes. 100% all say they would rather go to the comedy concert. Laughing is just fun. All right, here's my second test. Test number two. You are at a party. Would you rather be stuck all evening talking to a person who is great at telling stories and telling jokes that makes you laugh, or would you rather be stuck by the joy sucker?
I would rather have some joy, I think.
Yeah, exactly. You'd rather laugh. Now, do you know what I mean by the joy sucker? Have you encountered that person?
Oh, totally.
Yeah. They exist. I got to tell you, I know for a certain fact that they exist. They just suck the joy right out of the room. And so here's a story. I was teaching this class it was dead. I mean, I was just bombing all morning. No one was laughing at my jokes. No one was having a good time. And I was like, what am I doing wrong? Well, then we had lunch. We came back from lunch. Same thing. All of a sudden at 2 o'clock, this guy who had been sitting in the middle of the room with a white starched, shirt, had to go. He left the class. Immediately, boom, everyone started lighting up and started talking and laughing. I'm telling you, that guy was a joy sucker. I saw it firsthand. All right. Well,
wow.
Well, now I know you do improv, and today I want to explore how to do improv and the benefits of doing improv to our lives, including our vocation. And so, but first, I want to find out from you, what is your experience in the whole improv area?
Sure. So when I was taking those after school classes when I was 7 and 8 years old, our teacher was a man who we called him Mr. Miles, and he was incredible. He was just so full of energy. He wrote all the scripts. We did children's theater. It was so fun. But he was really big on just having fun. And if you forgot your line, you could make it up.
Okay.
And if somebody forgot their line, you could save them by either saying their line or making up something that went along with the story. And I started praying for people to drop their line, because I wanted to jump in there and either say their line for them, because I was also a little know-it-all, or make something up. And, because we were kids, if a kid ever got sick, Mr. Miles would step in and Mr. Miles would do improv. And I would love to just go in and have a quick conversation with Mr. Miles on stage in front of everybody. And so I got caught with the make-em-up bug very, very early on in the context of theater, in the context of, if you're aware of what's going on around you and the script fails you, or you fail the script, you don't have to fail the character or the show necessarily.
The show must go on.
The show must go on. And then in college, I joined a short form improv troupe. So that's like the games that you see on Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Okay, right.
And which was super fun. And then the summer before my senior year of college, I went to Chicago. I did an internship in Chicago and also took an actor's improv intensive, or the improv intensive at the Second City, which I was a huge, huge, huge Tina Fey fan ever since I was young. And I loved her when she wrote Mean Girls. I loved her way before she started playing Sarah Palin. And then when everybody started loving her because she was Sarah Palin, I was like, oh, you don't understand. She's so much more than that. But So I went to Second City, and I worked there. I worked on improv there. I worked at a theater called The Annoyance, which is a lot more obscure stuff, which is really good for me. And I went back to school, tried to apply a little bit of that. Actually, I ended up writing my thesis on some humor theory and American drama. And then when I moved to New York right after college, I studied at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, which was started by Amy Poehler, Matt Besser, Ian Roberts, and Matt Walsh. And I studied all through there, got into advanced study improv, and then actually did their whole comedy sketch program and wrote for a sketch show there called Night Late, which is basically a late night show that we craft around the host every month. And so I did that for about 2 years.
Man, there's a lot to unpack there, but I want to touch on what you said at the beginning, and that is when you are doing a play, and let's say there is a script to follow, you seem to really crave the opportunity to go off script. And why is that?
I think that there are a couple of reasons. Number one is that as a kid, confidence has never been an issue for me. And I frequently think, not as much anymore. I have a little bit more trust, but as a kid, I definitely thought that I could have written something better. Or that, you know, I could punch up this joke or something like that. The other thing was that I loved to read a room. I loved to see what the audience was giving and respond to that more than just say what was on the page or say what my character was supposed to say. Now, what that makes me really is a bad actor, but a pretty darn good comedian. So it's part of the reason why I transitioned.
Now, I think there's something about you're really being alive. You are in the moment. Now, when I do oral argument before a court, it's the same way. You don't know how it's going to go, but you don't know what questions the judge is going to ask. You don't know which direction the argument's going to go. So you do all this preparation. But that aside, there is no script. You are off the cuff. You are in the moment. It feels like you are really alive and present. And I think in improv, it's the same way. I mean, you don't know what the person's going to say. You are just responding in the moment. And I don't know, there's just something. I'm not an athlete. I like to play sports, but I'm wondering if that's what athletes feel when they're in the moment.
Well, and that was always, you know, even when I was, I played basketball for 12 years. I started basketball the same year that I started theater. And I played very competitively for almost my entire career. But like I said before, I was very tall. I was huge until I was 10, and then I never grew again. And so I had to adjust throughout my career to, you know, being the tallest person on the court, you know, just don't drop the ball and then shoot after you pick it up over everybody's head, to, okay, you're going to have to be the smartest. You're going to have to know the most about the game, and you're going to have to read the game the best, because I was never going to be the fastest and I was never going to be the biggest. And I think that that's, you know, very applicable in both improv and in law. Again, I am absolutely not a lawyer. But I did go to Harvard like Elle Woods. So I think that that's a little bit like that. I have played lawyers in shows. So I think I'm relatively qualified to say that you know, it's the at a certain point in certain situations, you're not convincing a person who knows the law, you're convincing 12 civilians, 12 peers. And that's a whole different, you know, you can know what you're talking about backwards and forwards, but if you can't read the room, if you can't see where sentiment is going, if you can't acknowledge that you're all humans living together and, you know, make a quick joke about something that happened earlier in the day or how the coffee is bad or how, you know, like this is day 5 of a, you know, weird trial and everybody's tired, you're not gonna be as successful as somebody who can read the room and respond to it while also, and something talked about a lot at the UCB, while also operating at the height of your intelligence.
Right, Taylor, I think you hit the nail on the head there. So I want to just focus on that, because whether you are doing oral argument before an appeals court or you are in front of a jury of your appeals, your peers, it's still all about making a connection in the moment. You are trying to communicate and make a connection with that audience. And improv is really the same thing. It's about making that connection in that moment.
Absolutely.
So what is improv? Tell us, if I were to attend a class on improv, do you have a clinical definition for us in the comedy sense?
So in the comedy sense, and it's very funny. I was talking with my partner today. We met in an improv class, and we are both comedians, and so we're living the funny life together. And we were talking today about how improv, the way we learned it in New York, is very different than the improv that my sister is learning at Second City in Chicago, or that I learned when I was there. But at the end of the day, what it is making things up completely originally in front of an audience and doing the opening and closing night of whatever show you're doing. Del Close, who's an improv guru from IO in Improv Olympic in Chicago, who also came to the UCB, would say it's like building a 747 in the air.
All right, I like that.
It is the construction of itself happening live before your eyes. And there are some theaters like The Annoyance in Chicago who say that's the whole fun, no more rules. That's it. The rule of improv is you get on stage and you do it and you try to have fun. And then there are some theaters like the UCB who have a very pretty strict formula for what their style of improv is. And it's, you know, it takes all the classes to learn and everything, but what it's really about is finding something funny and then doing it a lot of time and making it a little bit more intense every time.
Okay. I like that. In fact, I think this is a improv is really a metaphor for life. I mean, as Yoda said, well, I really have no idea what Yoda said, but I kind of like to think what Yoda would have said. And so maybe something like improv life is, or rehearsals for life does no one. I mean, I don't know what Yoda would have said, but I like the idea that it's just spur of the moment. It's living in the moment. There is no dress rehearsal for life. We're living it as we go. And so I like that concept. I think improv is a metaphor for life. So now, why did you get involved in improv? Of all the different kinds of comedic things you could have been involved with, why improv?
So improv, at least in my experience and the experience that I've had, is improv can be helpful and sort of thought-provoking for anything that you're doing, whether it is in comedy or in performance or in creation, period. Because the foundational tenets of improv end up being the foundational tenets of creating a lot of things. And so I got involved because I knew that I wanted to do comedy, and I knew that there was a theater in New York that did that, that worked on that. But also because I wanted to be around other people who were interested in that type of thing, because one of the biggest and most important things about improv is that you're sharing the stage with other people. And one of the most fun and rich things about improv is surrendering that control while also feeling in control and trusting another person to build an airplane with you while you're hurtling through the sky.
Yeah, that sounds intimidating. It sounds fascinating, exhilarating. Now, maybe I shouldn't ask this, but have you ever bombed on stage?
Oh, all the time.
What happened?
Oh gosh, I'm trying to think of the worst. Well, I did a show at the Kansas City Fringe Festival 2 years ago, and I came out to do my first show. It was basically an hour of stand up and storytelling, that I was going to do a show with my sister, and then she had had a work thing come up and couldn't come. So I did the show, and the first night I came out and it went amazing. I was like, this is the best. I love it. Whatever. The next night went pretty well too. And then the next night it was just crickets the whole time.
Wow. I didn't expect that.
And I don't think I did anything different, you know? But one of my favorite stories, ever was I had an acting teacher in college named Scott Ziegler who developed the acting term or the acting school of thought called Practical Aesthetics with William H. Macy and David Mamet. Just like truly one of the most brilliant men I've ever met. And he tells a story of two actors. And on the first night, the male actor asks the female actor for a kiss. He's like, may I have a kiss? And the crowd went nuts. It was just, they had to stop for 5 minutes. Everybody was laughing. You know, a huge to do. And the next night it didn't happen. There just wasn't the laughter. And the next night he said it again and there wasn't the laughter. And this actor went up to his scene partner and he said, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's different from the first night. And she said, well, that night you asked for a kiss, not for a laugh.
Interesting.
And I think to me there's so much truth in improv is the most fun when your characters are believable and they really believe in what they're doing.
Man, that is a good story. But I will also just put in my two cents where sometimes it's on the audience. I mean, I just got to say sometimes
totally.
I have been in front of audiences that are just so fun and laughter is contagious. And when they're laughing, and I don't know why they're having, maybe it's a guy who went up before me, got them laughing, but it just makes my job so much easier.
Totally. And I liken it to, and the energy feeds off of itself. It's kind of like, I'm not going to get the term right because I'm not a runner, but there is the, you know, you have your pushers in running. And even if you're basically like, if you're running a race and you're, you know, hundreds of yards in front of the person behind you, you have a smaller chance of getting a PR.
Right.
Because you're not being pushed. If you don't have somebody breathing down your neck, you're not going to get that momentum. You're not going to get that competition to get to the highest level of your performance.
Right. Well, that's a great concept for life and career and goal setting.
Totally. And that's how it works with laughter, I think, too. It's like you take that energy and you want to make them laugh harder. You want to make them laugh more. You're feeling how they, you know, you can be more in tune to laughter. So yeah, it is on audiences and performers bear no responsibility. And if nobody laughs at me, it's their fault.
That's right. Hey, I'm good with that. I am very good with that. So, well, I want to actually do improv. So walk us through. Now, I know you said rule number one. There are no rules, but aside from that, help us out here. Give us some guidelines, some parameters of some rules that I guess we could then choose to not follow. But nonetheless, give us some tips on how we can do improv.
Totally. So I think the most common one that a lot of people use and that has been, you know, it's the name of, or it's featured in the name of Amy Poehler's book and Tina Fey talks about it too. And that's the idea of yes and.
I like that.
And basically what that is that people want to watch two people on stage who are on the same page. And it doesn't, and I'll get to that in a second. It doesn't necessarily mean that the characters on stage have to agree with each other all the time, but more that the actors agree and the performers agree on the world that they're creating.
See, this is fascinating to me because already this is well beyond what I thought. My dad always told me that when I need to use the yes and whenever I'm ordering dessert after a meal, it's like, yes, I'll take that. And I also would like some ice cream on top. But you're saying it's even beyond just ordering off the dessert menu.
It's beyond that, but it does include that. If you say to me, if we're doing a scene, we're starting, because keep in mind, we're on a stage, there's nothing in front of us, we're sitting in chairs, and you say, Taylor, I think I'm going to have the apple pie. What I could say if I'm a bad improviser, if I'm a bad partner, is why would you want an apple pie? We're in space.
All right, right? Right, right.
I'm rejecting the reality that you've presented us with. I'm switching it to my own. And the only thing that we know about each other is that we disagree on whether or not we can have apple pie in this place.
I get that.
Whereas if you said, you know, Taylor, would you like some apple pie? I said, thanks, Joel, so much for inviting me to dinner. I also want some ice cream. Do you like pistachio? And then we get to go, right?
So the concept is no matter what you say, I'm going to respond to it with a yes and somehow add to the story.
Yes, now, 100%.
Why is that an improv technique?
I think that, you know, there are some improv techniques that are people choosing sort of how they want the art form to go. This one, I just think is because that's what we want people to watch. That's how scenes work. That's how, you know, people interact with one another. And we have to start, you know, we have to agree sort of step by step that we are, to continue this metaphor, that we are building this plane and that we both want to fly it. And if you can think of, it also makes it easier for the two people in the scene, right? If you tell me, you know, I've really been thinking about this apple pie all day. What's going to be easier? Me taking what you just said and adding something to it, or me thinking of something all on my own, right? It's so much easier and more fluid for me to say, he's been thinking about apple pie all day. I totally get you. I've been thinking about brownies all day. Let's get both and share. Do you have the Chase Sapphire Rewards credit card? Because I want points.
Right, right, right.
You know?
Right. I like that.
Like and again, specifics are always, not again, I haven't said that yet, but specifics are also always, you know, they make everything funnier. That is just witch magic. We don't know why.
Okay, so so another general rule, which we might cover later, but if we don't, let's give the audience what they paid for, specifics of a situation. And the more specific you can get, the funnier that story will be.
Yes, and I tell this to my college essay students, and it's something that the great improviser from Chicago, Susan Messing, once said, which is, medicine is good, cough medicine is better, Robitussin wins every time.
All right. I like that.
That's all it is. It's if I say like, Hey, could you pass me the medicine? I've been feeling a little puny today. You know, that's fine, but it seems like we're talking in vague things. Whereas, you know, like I've never asked my boyfriend for the medicine.
Right. Right. Right, right.
I ask him for the NyQuil or, you know, the Miller Lite or whatever, you know.
It depends on how sick you are, and right.
Yeah, it depends on what kind of medicine I need. So that's another small one. But along those specifics, another big one about those first two lines in a scene, first two or three lines, is to establish. And I think this is forgive my limited knowledge, but this to me appears a very legal thing. Is establish who, what, and where as soon as possible.
Okay. And what do you mean by that?
So if we start a scene and I say to you, where have you been? And you say to me, at the carnival. What do we know about the two people on stage? We know that one of them has been at the carnival. That's the end. We don't know who they are to one another. We don't know where they are now because they're talking about where they were before. And we don't know what they're doing. Are they standing around? Are they walking? Are they folding laundry? Are they churning butter?
Right.
What are they doing?
All we know is that one of them was at a carnival and he probably likes fried food because what else do you do at a carnival?
Right.
But I get that. Right.
Right. We can infer all day, but we will never know. Whereas if we start something like, you know, if somebody says, Colin, where have you been? And the person responds, Mom, can I take one bite of dinner before you yell at me? Then we know everything. It's Colin and his mom. They're eating dinner. And what's going on and or where they are is it a kitchen or in a restaurant? Again, we can elaborate. It's not, Colin, welcome to the kitchen. Where have you been? Mother, you know, we don't need to telegraph it, but we're going to have such an easier time, us as performers, if we know that I'm Mom and you're Colin, and you think your instinct is to think that I, your mom, am going to yell at you.
Okay.
Now we have a lot of stuff to work with.
I like that. So when you are up there on stage doing improv, you're trying to be thinking off the cuff, you want to, as soon as you can, establish the relationship. So the who, what, where, as soon as possible, because that helps to bring the audience along with the story.
Yes. It helps to bring the audience along with the story, and it helps you and your scene partner decide what you're working with. And we talk about that a lot in improv. What it's called is gifting your scene partner.
I like that. Right? Okay.
Like if I say to you, oh, I hope, like the other sort of thing that we talk about in improv is if your scene partner tells you not to do something, what they're asking you is to absolutely do it, probably multiple times.
All right.
So, you know, if I say to you, oh, I know how much you hate birds, but please don't start singing we will rock you at them to scare them, right? What we have just agreed on, what I have gifted you as my scene partner, and what we have just agreed on is that this scene is now about every time we see a bird, you're going to sing we will rock you.
At some point, that's coming out. Is that right? Queen? Yeah, Queen's coming out.
Yeah, at some point it's coming out. And that's such a gift for you because now you know what to do. And you can gift me back, you know, something along the lines of, okay, but if you put your hand over my mouth, I'm going to bite you again. And now we know that I am supposed to, you know, try to put my hand over your mouth, but be afraid that you're going to bite me. And we've told each other that very explicitly on stage, but now we get to go play with it. Now we get to what we refer to, which is more of a Second City thing, but UCB does it too, is we follow the fun. And that's pretty self-explanatory. It's fun to scream, we will rock you at imaginary birth.
Right.
That for a little bit.
Yeah, I even heard Seinfeld one time talk about writing a joke that he just came across a word that was just fun to say. So he wrote an entire, piece just off of being able to say one word because it was a fun word to say. Now, so is that a rule in, or at least a thought in improv that you are always looking to help your partner and make them look good?
Yes. So it's sort of a duality. There's not a hardcore rule. I suppose that we say. And again, the idea of sort of sharing with your scene partner, and there's not exactly a rule around it, but you are acknowledging that like this is the person that you're building this plane with. And one of the big things that we say, or we don't say this, but something that Amy Poehler said in her book, Yes, Please, which I think is just wonderful, is everything is so much easier if you do improv believing that your scene partner is a genius and knows exactly what they're doing.
Ah, I like that.
Always. So if you say something or if I say something that completely throws you off, that feels to you super, super wrong, you can decide to try to fight me. You can decide to, as we say, no but me instead of yes anding me because you think that I have misunderstood something you've said or I'm taking the scene in a way that you don't want it to go. But the thing about improv is that you don't get to decide where the scene goes. The scene gets to decide where the scene goes. And if you believe that I am a genius and know exactly what I'm doing, then you get to respond to that. And it's going to make you way more sure of yourself. And then I'm going to reciprocate in kind.
Okay.
And there's no way to avoid it, right? You're creating this wonderful third thing of what you think the scene is and what I think the scene is. And then those two things both clashing and colliding and connecting make the scene.
So follow the fun. So if it's just... You know, and as, I guess it's more of an instinct. You're just kind of following your gut there. It's like, hey, this is enjoyable. Maybe you got a little bit of audience response. It's fun to say. It's just fascinating to you. So it triggers your curiosity. Just follow that fun there. And then your last tip.
The last one is there. So like there, it's kind of two together, right? And that is. That when you follow the fun, when you find the fun or you find what the scene is, for instance, let's say you scare birds by singing We Will Rock You.
Okay.
Okay. So then we ask ourselves the question, if this is true, then what else is true? So if you're a person who scares birds by singing We Will Rock You, do you end dinner parties at your home by singing Closing Time? Do you, like, wake up your kids by singing the Good Morning song from Singing in the Rain? What does it mean? Where else can we go? What other fun can we follow if what we know about the scene, if what we've agreed to, if what we've yes-anded is that you sing at things when they are a problem, right? And we can ask that question so many times. What do you do when you actually hear a song? How do you respond to that? Et cetera, et cetera. And then sort of the extra rule there or the extra thing that we can infuse through all of this, it's going to make it much more effective and make everyone able to, and I think this is particularly particularly important for people in law, to present the most authentic version of yourself is to what we say, play at the height of your intelligence.
Oh, I like that.
And that means just because we're playing around, just because we're on a stage, just because we're like you put so perfectly, right? Follow the fun because you get audience interaction. Yeah, absolutely. One of the fun things is getting that high of a laugh. So if you know that you're going to get a laugh, follow it. But play at the height of your intelligence. If we've identified the fun thing that shouting we will rock you at birds is what you do. The height of my intelligence is not to say, oh yeah, because these birds like were at the Queen concert, at the Live Aid concert, and they remember and it makes them sad. So they fly away from the song. That's much less interesting, I think, to make the funny thing the birds rather than to operate at the height of my intelligence and say, why do you feel the need to sing the whole song? Can't you just shout at them? Then you're giving the other person the gift of having to explain themselves, having to justify themselves and say, you know, I always sing to get my problems out. And then we get to go into the, if this is true, then what else is true? But if you're not playing at the height of your intelligence, you're going to lose the audience. They're not going to be able to focus on the fun because they're going to be saying, okay, wait, everything about this is so weird. And I think that, again, I am not a lawyer, but I think that that's relatively prescient for arguing cases. The idea that if we're like hinging our argument on singular pieces of evidence or singular events, we have to make sure that everything else, when we're talking about it, we're talking about at the height of our intelligence or at the height of the jury's intelligence or at the height of the judge's intelligence, so that we can identify the gaps and the differences and the inconsistencies in a way that feels legitimate.
Interesting. So it's the whole idea of having it make sense, wrapping a bow around it. If you speak at the highest level of your intelligence, you're saying that fills in the gaps. I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. Well, so just walk us through, if you can, quickly here. What is a typical improv experience? So, I mean, if I'm going to go to the club, I'm going to pay the buy the ticket and show up there. How long is this evening going to last? What will I expect to see?
So it really depends on the theater. At UCB, it's different than Second City. At Second City, usually what you're going to see is you're going to see a sketch show. So stuff that they've written before. And then at the end, you'll see sort of Whose Line Is It Anyway style improv games, where they try to find material to make other sketches in kind of a Saturday Night Live type of way. If you come to UCB, on the other hand, they are doing an improv style that is called the Herald, or their house team. So if you go on a weekday to UCB, they're doing something called the Herald. So you go in, you buy your ticket. It's very cheap. It's between $7 and $12 always. You go get a drink at the bar. You go in, and they'll come out and they'll say, we're going to do a Herald. They'll tell you a little bit about it, and they'll get a one-word suggestion from the audience. And based on that suggestion, they will do something called the Herald. So the Herald is an improv form developed by Del Close that is named Herald because they said, what is this called? And he said, I think I'll call it Herald. And it's a very, like, if you see it, you're probably not going to know what you're seeing if you see it for the first time, but you're going to get a lot out of it. So they'll ask for a one-word suggestion from the audience, and then off of that, they'll do an opening, some type of weird thing. It's different for every team. Then you'll go in and you'll see three improv scenes. Then they'll do something all together as a group. Then you'll see three more improv scenes that are based on the three you saw before. Then they'll do a big thing as a group. And then at the end, the really amazing teams at UCB will somehow connect all three scenes together. And it's very weird and cool. And the first time you see it, you probably will have no idea what you're watching, but it's going to be so fun and so funny that, it's just really incredible to behold. And every once in a while, you'll hear a couple of people behind you saying something like, well, that's not the one that they make up. Sometimes they make them up. And then somebody will tell them, no, they made that whole thing up. And then they fight about it because some people don't believe it. That's about 30 minutes. And then usually there's another team. And by that time you're hooked. On the weekend, it's the best improvisers in New York just messing around. They're playing with form. They're playing with suggestions. My favorite team is a team called Bucky, and they just ask people about their weekends and their weeks and what went on in their weeks, and they improvise scenes kind of based on the lives of the people that they spoke to in the audience. So it really runs the gamut. It's a really versatile art form because you just need a bunch of bodies and some people to laugh.
So if someone listening wants to get involved in improv, I mean, how would they go about doing it? Can they just show up on a Thursday night at the improv? How do you go about getting on stage?
So there are a lot of different ways in New York. In Texas, actually, there's a really big improv community. Boston, Kansas City, where I'm from, has a great one. LA, plenty of cities all over the country. Washington, D.C. have a really, really great improv communities. And there are a bunch of different ways. Some schools, you know, just sign up for a class, but sometimes those are expensive. There are a lot of classes in New York, and I know in places around the country that have what are called drop-ins. So you go in for a 3-hour class and it's either no money or a very small amount of money. A lot of places have improv jams, which are usually free and open to the public. And you put your name in a hat and they pull out 8 people at a time and you get up on stage and you play. At UCB, if you go, you can play with some of the UCB performers. I went to a jam one time where Sasheer Zameda from SNL was just on stage playing with people doing improv at the UCB. So it was there are a lot of great opportunities. Even if you don't live in New York, either get up on stage in jams, go to workshops, go to classes, then sign up for longer classes with levels. And, you know, you can also go online and look up some stuff and grab a bunch of people and get in a room and try it out. You know, nobody's going to tell you you're right or wrong because this is a completely made up thing that will never happen again. And everybody is just being a grown up and playing pretend.
Well, I want to see you on a stage with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler here soon. But, but I do want to give you the last word, and that is this question. Because you are in the corporate world as well, and you are in the comedic world. How do you think that your improv experience has impacted you in the corporate world?
I think that something that for me, particularly as a young woman coming in from the Midwest to sort of hard-hitting New York and being a creative, a couple of things, but the two big ones are playing at the height of my intelligence all the time and thinking that the people around me are geniuses and know exactly what they're doing. One, playing at the height of my intelligence, you know, I am kind of a know-it-all. I'm very loud. And so there's a difference between being professional, having class, knowing when to speak, and demurring when you know that people in the room are wrong, when you know that there is something to be said for yourself, for your work, for the creative, for, you know, whatever you're doing. And so some playing at the height of my intelligence and realizing that bringing my best self to the table all the time actually benefits the entire group, even if it doesn't always feel comfortable, even if it doesn't feel like yes anding, really ends up bringing the whole thing together and really ends up benefiting the people that I'm around. Great. Is a big one. And then the other one is thinking everybody around me is a genius and knows exactly what they're doing. If I trust that the people around me have my best interests at heart and they trust that I have theirs, we're going to get somewhere better. And that doesn't always happen immediately. You know, you have to find chemistry with a team. But that's something that I really strive for in my professional relationships, my personal relationships, my comedy relationships, is to first of all, get rid of my self-doubt, but also find relationships with people who I think are geniuses and know exactly what they're doing.
Great ideas, great tips. And so thank you so much for having us on. I do appreciate your time, and I do look forward to seeing you, I guess, maybe on the improv or comedic circuit in the near future.
Thanks so much, Joel. This was so fun.
Well, thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law, especially with the Supreme Court now in session, and we'll be reporting on the Supreme Court news as it happens. So I want to give a special shout-out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom, well, let's just face it, this entire operation would be a complete and utter mess. Our marketing team, Redbird Solutions, and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. For those of you that hear me in person, yeah, you know exactly what I am talking about. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.